79th episode of Does Your Favorite Movie Suck, where we revisit great movies from the 80s and 90s that actually might suck. My name is Caitlin.
My name is Travis Sintel. What a day we have here.
I guess. I mean, I said the only thing I have to say about this movie is you're excited and I'm not.
So. Yeah. Can I tell you a
so
secret?
Great.
I'm not excited. I was just trying to like muster a little bit of it, you know, verve. I realized something.
Yeah.
And I have sincere questions for you about this. So I don't have answers. I know for a fact I saw this film in the theaters.
Yeah,
saw it in the theaters.
Okay.
I am quite confident of that. I remember the experience of going to the theaters. I remember being confused by the asterisk in front of the title. That was a thing that I remember feeling as a child.
Mm-hmm.
I know that there are small flying saucers in this film.
Yeah.
I don't actually know if they're robots or aliens. And I don't know anything about the film, I realized. I was thinking on the way over here, nothing about this film is stuck in my head.
Me neither. I mean, the only thing I know is that this movie... This is so dumb. This movie's so dumb to do. I mean, I know that some people like it, but I can't imagine anybody knows what
it is. Bag's
it's one
big.
Of those movies.
No,
that
our bag
just
is
like
too big.
Fallen.
This is Police Academy 5.
But this
of the
is
sci-fi
but
realm.
This might movie might be fine, I guess. But it is the exact hybrid in the sense that in my mind, unless I had watched these movies, I would have no idea what the difference was between this, Short Circuit, and Cocoon.
Yeah,
they would be the same movie to me.
Wait, Cocoon.
Cocoon.
Are there old people in Batteries Not Included?
I thought so until I watched Cocoon. I'm like, oh, that's not that one. So
oh.
This one has...
Oh, wait.
I also would have told you Steve Guttenberg's in this. I don't think so.
Oh, hold on, though. Okay, I actually remember some of this. Okay, here's my problem. My heuristic, when I was thinking about Batteries Not Included, I was trying to conjure up a plot about a kid, and I couldn't do it. This is a movie about old people.
I don't think it's about – well, maybe some are old people. I think in the
because now my brain's firing
truly one second of research I did about this.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I read the word like housing project.
Okay.
So I think it's little aliens – and I know the VHS cover, which is a little ship in like
is it aliens
window.
Or robots?
I think it's aliens. But it's called Batteries Not Included, so like there's so it just falls between two other movies we don't like. So great, like what a great movie to watch.
I'm imagining someone who's tuning into this podcast for the first time, listening to two grown men try to just guess what's in a movie from the 80s.
This is great. Can you imagine? Is there a better movie title to be like, what do you think that movie is? And everyone's like, oh yeah, 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 and then they're like, oh,
yeah, you don't know.
I don't know.
Well, that's what's funny.
I think everyone would be stumped by this. What's this fucking movie about?
No
Who's
one
in
knows.
This movie?
It's just kind of funny. But here's the thing. I had a positive name recognition. I think most people would. It's a good title.
It is a good title.
People remember the title, I think.
Aside.
Yeah. I do know I saw it in the theaters.
It's a good title with an asterisk.
Asterisk
is questionable.
Yeah. I enjoyed it. I feel like it's a sweet spot for our podcast in that it has name recognition. People think they like it, I suspect.
It's got that 80s Amblin sci-fi vibe, so this is another post-ET, I'm sure.
Yep. I bet you it's late 80s, right? 87, 88, 89.
It's got to be mid.
Okay.
It's got to be mid.
So ET is 82.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, maybe 85.
I mean, this is – Short Circuit is 85.
Yes.
Is that what we decided?
I bet it's post-Short Circuit.
Yeah, it's 87. Mm. 60% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Great.
3 out of 4 by Roger Ebert.
Will you do a favor for me?
Oh, fuck.
There are
old people in this movie.
Oh, see.
This is lame. Why are we watching this? We already watched this movie.
I can't wait. Well, listen, if you were to say to me, Travis, do you want to take a Saturday afternoon and watch a complete intersection of Cocoon and Short Circuit? I'd say, sign me up. I'm ready to do that. Let's go. So
okay.
I don't have anything to say about this film, obviously. I think we should just watch it.
Mm.
We should really challenge ourselves to have a nice time with it.
Yeah. You're right. Okay, let me just take a minute here. Let's just take a minute
reset.
In intro.
Let's reset.
To just say, it could be great.
It could be super fun.
It could be great.
Because here's the thing. Short Circuit, had it had a plot and no racism, would have been so fun. So this could be
we should remind ourselves that I think that literally this is the same writers as Short Circuit, at least in part. The guys who wrote Short Circuit wrote this. Now that seemed like a knock, but they also wrote Short Circuit too.
Which is great.
Which is fantastic.
Will you look up the writers? I just want to know who they are and what they went on to do. Because this feels relevant in terms of getting us excited. Is that supposition that you're posing correct. That's my first question, because so far a lot of factual questions on this.
This is also directed by Matthew Robbins, who is a Guillermo del Toro collaborator. He co-wrote Crimson Peak and Mimic.
Yeah, great.
And among other things, and he also did that Dragon movie.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
But while you're researching, how many writers were on this?
I got something for you.
Okay.
I got something for you, dude.
You're looking at the phone. You're very excited.
I mean, this is just anything to hang on to.
I can't wait.
I believe this is the first credit Brad Bird ever had.
Oh, as a writer.
As a writer.
Well, this is going to be great. This is pre-Iron Giant.
So I am right that the team behind Short Circuit contributed to this as well. They are also the guys who wrote Tremors. Yes. So, interestingly, all right.
That's going to be fun, man. Okay, here we go. Listen, Brad Bird meets Short Circuit meets Cocoon. Sign me up, everyone. This is going to be the best day of our lives.
So, if we're putting this shit on a continuum.
Yes.
These guys have a funny career now that I'm looking at it. So, they write Short Circuit. It's fucking trash, but it's a hit.
Yeah.
Then they were brought on by, maybe by, this might be like a Spielberg thing, onto Batteries Not Included. Then they wrote Short Circuit 2. Then they wrote Tremors. Then they wrote Ghost Dad. So anyway, it goes wrong. But this arc.
Where does it go wrong to you?
Ghost Dad. Okay. What are you kidding me?
I'm just making sure. Because I would argue it goes wrong at the beginning. But go on.
Well, yeah, but it starts bad. And then what I'm saying is, if Batteries Not Included comes while they're getting good, like maybe they got good because Short Circuit 2 is so good. They learned a lot, obviously. And maybe they learned it on Batteries Not Included. It was because Steven Spielberg taught them a thing or two. And then they delivered Tremors, which is great.
Yeah. I would say
forgot everything
Spielberg
about Ghost
Dad. Is almost certainly involved in the development process of this film. Don't you think?
The title's too good for him not to be.
That's what I think. It's a Spielbergian title.
It is. Yeah. It really is. There could be a Spielbergian title, that's it.
This is not appropriate for a podcast. You're not going to see Ready Player One.
I saw it.
You did see it?
Yeah.
All right. Well, off air that.
No, let's talk about it now. Okay, we've got nothing else to talk about.
Here's the thing. Listeners, Kalen makes these broad proclamations about things he will not do. He will not see a Marvel film. He will not see these movies. And I believe, I'm fairly confident, Kalen was like, not going to see Ready Player One. Not going to do it. And then next thing I know, he's done it.
This is what you do. And I can't believe we've been friends as long as we have, and you don't know really basic and fundamental things about me. I wouldn't say that about Ready Player One, obviously.
Because of Spielberg?
Yes.
Okay.
And I stick by 90% of the proclamations I make, and they're all 75%. They're very clear. 83. I'll give you 83. I mean, the Marvel thing is true.
Yeah.
The Star Wars thing is true.
Yeah.
I will watch them. I see them eventually because I fucking rent them.
Okay.
My rule is $2 or less per Disney franchise movie.
Okay. And you liked Ready Player One?
It's fine. This is a dumb conversation to have, but there's one incredible sequence and one pretty cool sequence, and the rest is like whatever.
I read the book when it first came out.
Yeah.
I had no interest in seeing the film, but one line of one review made me want to see it, mm-hmm. which was that the book is a full on. I mean, obviously, this if you guys don't know the book, it basically what came in the pre Gamergate wave. And made the argument basically that the skills that these sort of disenfranchised white males had spent their lifetime acquiring had a use, that there was that pop culture knowledge had a use, that gaming expertise had some sort of external real world validity and practicality, mm-hmm. And then Gamergate comes and the history does not smile upon Ready Player One as a novel. Ernest Cline's second book is in the same genre, and people trashed the shit out of it. Mm-hmm. And like this argument has no place in modern society. The ship has sailed, buddy. Get out of here. So the movie starts to come out. It gets announced, and I'm very skeptical of it because I had a fine experience reading the book, but it wasn't transcendent for me anyway. I just thought, well, this argument's dead now. We can't make this argument anymore, and good riddance to it, quite mm-hmm. frankly. But I read a line in a review that said Spielberg took that sort of a step up and made a meta-level conversation about the regurgitation and consumer sort of culture when it comes to nostalgia in the 80s and 90s. And that line of that review interested me because I think he has something to say about that.
I didn't the most surprising thing about the movie is that I didn't find it to be particularly deep indulgence in nostalgia at all. It kind of wasn't even about that. There's a little bit of window dressing about that, and it's sort of like, like the DeLorean, like that's kind of what it's like. But the story is a bland story just unto itself, which kind of has something to do with nostalgia, I guess, because that's sort of what the world is. But it doesn't.
You don't think that review has any is accurate? Because now I really don't.
I just didn't find the movie compelling on any level like that at all. I was like, oh, this is just an excuse to create a CG playground for action stuff. And on that level, sometimes it's kind of good.
Okay.
That's it. Like, that was it. Like, I just didn't find the movie deep at all. Even in a way that would be fun to think about. I was like, okay. Yeah,
that was what I was hoping for. I was hoping to think about something about nostalgia in a fun way.
No, you'll think about how fucking awesome this racing sequence is, where, like, they have to race past King Kong.
That sounds pretty good.
It's great. Yeah. It's awesome.
And that's one of those movies that I should see on the big screen if I'm going to do it.
It would be fine to see it on, like, honestly, like, it would be fine to see it anywhere. It doesn't matter. It's right. Pretty cool.
Should we go watch Batteries Not Included?
Yep.
All right.
The residents of 817 East 8th Street are about to lose everything they have.
What do you mean those tenants are still in there?
Tonight. I'll have them out by tonight.
Nothing in this world can save them. Nothing but a miracle. Steven Spielberg presents a Matthew Robbins film.
Welcome to America. Spaceships from a very small planet. Very small.
Hey, Kaylin.
Hi. So this movie comes at a... Here's what I'm thinking. This movie comes at a particularly vulnerable time for this podcast.
Yeah.
In that... What number... Short Circuit was like number 3.
It was early. The top 5.
So, and this is... What are we on? 79?
Oh, yeah.
So it's been in 76 or 75, I guess, episodes. Mm. I haven't questioned whether we should even be doing this.
Yeah.
And... now I am again. I'm like, what's, and I mean, I'm not really, but like watching this movie, I was like, I hate it every second of it. It's making me feel sick and ill in my stomach and brain. And, I also don't know how to possibly talk about it.
Well,
so
it's
like,
angles.
How am I supposed to do? Why would we do this?
I mean, there's a couple things to discuss here. One is...
Can I just ask one question before you go into this?
I was going to say our bag is too big first.
Sure. I was just going to propose something.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I'm only half kidding about.
Yeah.
We could just scrap it. We could scrap this one.
Nope. I have things to say. I have things I want to say. And...
So you're saying you're going to assemble a show out of scrap metal.
Interesting. I see what you've done. Build something. I mean, we're already getting the clever ball rolling here. So let's just keep it pushing.
All right, but if you want to talk about this, you have to tell the story at some point.
I'm ready.
Like, good luck.
I'm fucking ready to do this.
Great.
I feel ready to do this. Okay, you know what? I'll start off with the story. Well, no, let me ask you a question before I start.
Okay.
And do not give me a flippant answer here. I want you to work through this.
Okay.
Who is this movie for when it was made?
Well.
And was that conversation had? Walk me through this. And then I will tell you the story of Batteries Not Included.
I mean, the thing about this movie is the answer is that audience doesn't exist anymore. The real answer is that they just aren't
alive
anymore.
Yeah,
I mean, or
that?
If they were, then they're old and it's different now.
You're saying
it was
for
family
adults.
Audiences. This is it's who it's for. It's supposed to be for families to go together.
Yeah. So kids, in theory, would enjoy this film.
Yeah.
And the tone of the film certainly is slapsticky. In parts.
Kind of.
And certainly. And then in other parts, there's like stillborn creatures being born on screen.
Yeah.
So it's just things that are obviously adult.
I mean, but just
confusing.
Think about the movies that we referenced before we started watching this. It's the who the
well,
who's Short Circuit for?
Short Circuit feels.
Who's it for?
That feels more clearly for children than, say, Cocoon, which
it
is.
Does?
I don't know who Cocoon's for. Yeah.
Short Circuit feels like it's for children, even though it's about a robot falling in love with an older woman.
Yeah.
And
robot. I mean, kids get what love is, and they get what robots are.
It's just, but you know problem? What I'm saying. Like, and who's Cocoon for? It's
well,
not
Cocoon
for...
is really confusing. I just don't understand. There's a genre of film where the protagonists are elderly people, that's geared towards children that I don't understand.
It's not for children. Fundamental level. Children is a big mistake.
But it's also not for adults.
And I don't think Short Circuit is for children.
It's also not for adults, though. This movie, if you're an adult,
it's
you look
for
at this
the child
go,
inside, bro. That's who. That's what Spielberg. That's how he got famous. That's why this fucking movie even exists, because of goddamn Steven Spielberg.
All right, here's the plot. I have a theory about how this movie came about, too. Uh-huh. I wanna
Who's Ready Player One for? Nobody.
You, apparently.
It's not really you for loved anybody. It. It's not for anybody, and it's for everybody. That's the answer.
This is more perplexing to me. The idea of having...
Well, but it's only perplexing because it sucks, man. Like, if this movie had been great, it'd be a family classic. You know, it just would be. That's just what it is.
But tonally, it would have been different to be great. This movie doesn't become great without a different... Look, let me just play the movie, and then I have a theory I want to float past you.
Okay.
All right, there are...
this is going to be good.
This
is going to be great.
There's an apartment building in New York City, and the first floor of it is a restaurant owned by Hume Cronin and Jessica Tandy, who are an elderly couple in real life and in the film.
Both of whom were in Cocoon, by the way.
Yeah. So the developer is trying to – the classic New York City white male developer is trying to knock down this building. They bought out everyone else around. They're trying to give money to these elderly folk to leave. Now, the only people left in the building are five people, two of whom have mental problems.
Actually, it's seven people, but fair enough.
Who's the other two?
Well, one of the old couples moves away.
Oh, right. But instantly.
Yeah.
So...
in the whole building.
Yeah. In the whole building, there's seven people. Two of them have an exodus quickly. Two-fifths of the remaining people have a mental disability. Jessica Tandy's is, I guess, Alzheimer's ? Yeah. But it doesn't work as Alzheimer's does.
It's cute old person disease.
Yeah, it's basically what it is. And then there's a African-American man who used to be a boxer who only speaks in catchphrases. That's his mental problem.
The implication, I guess, is that he's been beat. His brain has been beaten into stupidity.
That's what the movie asks you to believe. But they're...
he too, very cute.
Yeah, every trope you can think of in this
mental
character,
illness is delightful.
Yeah, it can be used
film.
For great comedic effect. So these
and
five people decide not to leave. And for about 25 minutes, the audience is subjected to a series of maudlin scenes of them basically saying goodbye to their current lives, looking at old folks' home brochures. The guy in the building.
Oh, God, it goes on forever.
Yeah, it's forever. The guy in the building... His name is Mason, and he's an artist.
This is one of the other characters,
yep.
Yeah.
So there's five, and it bears saying that all five of these play. So Jessica Tandy and Hume Cronin, that's one couple. You have the African-American ex-boxer. You have Elizabeth Pena, who's playing a very pregnant woman whose boyfriend is a traveling musician, and you have this guy Mason, who's an artist, quote unquote.
All right. Can I just say, can I just interject sometimes?
Oh, all the time.
Great.
Because it's already boring.
Yeah, I can't tell you, we say this a lot in this. Even as I sit here, and it is not your fault, and you are doing the Lord's work in trying to explain this movie.
Yeah.
I don't want to. I wish I could plug my ears.
Yeah. Oh, I get
because
it.
Because I don't want to hear this or think about it for one more second.
But wait. But here's what happens.
So here's what I was going to say.
Here's the magic.
But here's
up,
my interjection is. So we said this during Jacob's Ladder. I fucking love Elizabeth Pena. I like not just. I mean, and even forget about her as an actress because she's terrible in this. Because who isn't? But I fucking have a huge crush on Elizabeth Pena.
Yeah, you should.
I'm crazy about her.
Yeah, you should. Her voice is incredible. I would
Everything
say.
About her is amazing.
Yeah, she's great. She is the highlight. So look, anyway, all these people are in the nadir of their life here. This is a real problem for everybody, and the construction company is trying to tear down the building. And
what is their what motivation would you say the let's say Elizabeth Pena and the artist have for staying here?
I think they're broke. I think it's
broke.
I think they don't have any money to move.
I wish they'd said that.
Yeah.
Because they just seem like assholes.
For staying.
Like, what is wrong with you people?
Yeah, go, definitely go. It's time to go. and so then these flying robot aliens come and start floating around the building. And we learn that they can fix things, like electronics and stuff. And then...
Get ready for a lot of and thens, folks.
Wait, because I'm going to say...
Buckle up.
I'm going to say for the next
for the and then train.
70 minutes... Some things happen. So none of them are necessarily connected to each other. and none of them necessarily progress the plot forward. But I'll just give you a couple of these. Kalen, feel free to interject with some of your favorite things that happen.
Great.
Yeah, so one of the bits that happens is that the flying robot saucers refurbish the restaurant, which has been destroyed by some thugs trying to get them to move out of the building. And then there's this delightful scene where the flying robots are helping Hume Cronin make hamburgers. So that's fun, and that takes about 12 minutes. And then there's this other there's this other sequence where one of the flying robot creatures it gives birth to two more flying robot creatures, because I guess the two flying saucers mate in some way. They build some creatures out.
They don't even mate. They just like the I didn't understand why people. But I didn't understand why people were so stunned by that. Like we've seen them build all sorts of shit. They built themselves.
Here's why.
Themselves.
I'll tell you exactly why. I have the answer to that.
Okay.
Is because when you watch one get stillborn, it comes out of the.
No, I know. But why do they do it that way?
That is the craziest question I've ever asked. Because they do. That's the answer. That's why. So they're hollow inside. They give birth to two creatures, and they give birth to a third stillborn one, which is confusing and disturbing for a children family movie. And then that one is collected. Actually, even crazier, Jessica Tandy tries to bury it in a flower pot.
Oh, yeah.
And then...
And just, like, forget about it.
Yeah,
it's dead.
It's dead, and she's worn, and everyone's sad.
Which makes Elizabeth Peña flip out because the
she's pregnant.
Oh, my God.
Yeah,
so
there's
like,
a whole...
We do have to dig into some of these just so people understand why this movie is such garbage and why it's so annoying. So this is a good scene. This is a good example.
Yeah, it's
so
trying to do a thing
a
here.
Robot, a little robot, is stillborn... And everyone is very sad, and the guy, the sort of young guy who will heretofore be known as Mark Maron, because he looks like Mark Maron.
Or Richard Marks, or Dennis Miller.
He has Dennis Miller
or
hair
Kenny
for
Loggins.
Sure, and Mark Maron's face and beard,
yeah,
and the mannerisms of
a bad actor.
Yeah, it's so funny, because he's the lead, ostensibly the lead, and he is like, wow, did this not take off? Like,
yeah.
He failed in his – he's a charisma vacuum. Anyway, so he's been like, oh, boy, like, robots, like, this is a miracle of life, like, robots that can reproduce intelligently, all this stuff. And then when the stillborn baby is born, he's like, we got to open it up and see what's inside there. And this makes Elizabeth Peña insane. She's pregnant, you see.
Yes.
And so she's like, how dare you? You know, like, you want to tear it apart or whatever. Like, it never had a chance in this world. And she runs away. And he's like, what'd I do? What'd I do? And she's like, I'm scared about my baby, okay?
Obviously.
And he's like,
moron.
Huh?
Yeah. Also, the way they do the stillbirth scene, it just falls out in a dead lump on the table. And then they treat it like garbage. And it's walking a really curiously thin line here about how
nobody's thinking about this or cares. And so
then, the movie makes you do
so
it.
So then the mentally disabled, brain damaged ex-boxer guy frantically scoops it out of the flower pot, starts running, and they're like, "Stop him! What are you doing?"
Yeah.
Like,
and why are they trying to stop him, Kalen?
Totally unclear.
Great.
The guy, Mark Maron is like, "Why?" Like. He suddenly flips on a dime and is like, don't take that thing. Like, don't do it. You know, dumb guy, like, whatever you do. And then the dumb guy slams his door and locks it. And then he's like got this like creepy child smile on his face, which is not supposed to be creepy. It's supposed to be cute, but it's sickening.
It's gross
in every way.
Yeah.
So anyway, so then he tries to. So I'm going to take over for a moment. So
yeah,
he
yeah.
tries, because this is by far in the entire movie, my favorite scene. For the dumbest possible reason, but maybe, and I probably can't even explain why it's so funny. But so he's.
Kalen lost his mind when this happened. By the way, you guys, he laughed so hard, I can't even tell you.
I know there's no way you can understand why this is so funny. But so he's in this like classic '80s tinkering scene. You know, the guy has the tiny little robot open, and he's poking it with a fucking. You know, what do you call those things? What do you call those little sparky machines? Sparky screwdriver.
Yeah.
That's what he's doing with it. And that sets off a big spark and then a bunch of fire. And
he
the
may
fire
as well
up.
Have soot on his cheeks after that. It's like that kind of gag.
Yeah, yeah. You've seen it a million times. It's like it's in every 80s invention movie ever. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so he does that. Nothing happens. And he's like, oh, I've failed.
So then he throws the guy across the table.
No.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Then,
he throws it angrily, this dead robot baby.
Sort of weird, still, like, it reminds you, stillborn
with,
robot
it,
baby.
It has a face. Like, yes. The reason that we're, like, they all have faces. So they're anthropomorphized in a sort of short-circuity kind of way. So this is, for all intents and purposes, a dead robot baby.
Which is important to understand. Go on.
So he throws it in anger, And then, in frustration, he very violently props his feet on the table in like a harumph way. That hits one of the table's made out of boards of plywood. So that board suddenly catapults the dead baby robot across his apartment and into a sink full of dirty water.
Worse, it catapults it onto a shelf above the sink, which has plugged in electronics in it. The shelf then breaks, plummeting all of the baby and the toaster, literally a toaster
into the sink,
into
right.
a sink full of water.
So what I think, and so anyway, what happens then is that the baby comes to life
because
inside
it's
the drain. But what's so amazing about this is, again, the movie, it's not being sensitive or intelligent about this, but it is giving you the sentimental feeling of this little dead baby, this tiny little dead baby that he's tried to revive, failed, harumph, crash, splash, disaster. It's so funny. It comes out of nowhere, and it's supposed to be this really, like, I think it's supposed to be this touchingly sad scene then turns into a psychotic slapstick comedy moment.
Yeah. That actually is a good microcosm of the film. It doesn't know if it's trying to be sensitive. There's moments where Jessica Tandy's character breaks down because she's unsure if her son is dead or not. Like, it's really going for emotional beats amidst crazy slapstick.
And then it's just straight up Home Alone, or something ludicrously crazy.
Let me tell you something else that happens in this movie, Kalen.
I loved it.
So there's this guy,
and then I hated it again.
There's this guy.
For about 2 seconds there, I was in heaven.
You were happy. He laughed really, really hard. There's a guy, Mason, right? Who's an artist, and while they're being kicked out of the building, he takes all of his paintings after his girlfriend leaves him, and she says presciently, her closing line to him is, "You never even painted me nude." He's an artist.
His girlfriend.
Right. And so he very angrily takes all the paintings he has in his apartment. He throws them out of the window onto the street over Elizabeth Peña's apartment. She sees all these, you know, beautiful paintings, which are very, very, very bad, go onto the street. And then when
the
robots
are stunningly terrible.
I mean, stunningly bad.
It's awesome.
And she is taken by them. She's like, these are very good paintings.
Well, she's never seen a painting
in
her life.
So
she's just a dumb Latina.
Well, the idea, though, that someone could put paint on a canvas and make something vaguely realistic is impressive. Yeah. Very impressive. We find out that the robot saucers can fix things, which is not limited, curiously, to electronics. They can also fix doors, and they can fix pictures, and they can also fix paintings.
They can fix glass.
Yeah.
They can fix anything.
Anything. So they're magic robots. And one of the things they fix is all of his paintings, which have gone off to the dumpster. And
no,
they've...
No.
Yeah.
You're confused.
Am I?
I think you're confused about this.
What do you think happened here?
I think she just went out and got them.
You don't think they fixed them?
No.
You think that she...
Yeah, I think he threw them out the window in anger because his girlfriend left.
And she went and collected all of them.
Yes.
And the damage that the pictures had is
there
gone
was no
because...
damage.
I don't know if that's
what
true.
I think. I mean, I think she just went in, she was like, "Huh, that genius is throwing all his beautiful art out the window."
Yeah,
and then remember the guy saw a dump truck and he assumed, I guess, that they collected them all, but we didn't see that. And then the reveal was, no, she got them.
I have a question then. Why does she seem surprised that they're in her apartment undamaged?
She just forgot.
Wait.
That's really
okay.
What happened.
I'm basing my assumption on the idea that when she walks into her apartment, he's coming in after her. She seems shocked that there's paintings in
her
apartment.
No, she forgot. She didn't. She never expected the genius to come into her apartment.
Oh, that is a really weird decision.
No, that's what happens. And okay. Then she's like, "Go fuck. Like, he's going to know. I got all his paintings.
I have all his paintings." Okay. Anyway, all this builds to she thinks he's a genius. And they talk about it. And we cut at some point to him painting her, while in the background, two little baby robot saucers are play fighting with paintbrushes. All that
she
is
has
to
told,
say,
she said to him, by the way, I'm waiting for my boyfriend to come back.
She says, "I have a boyfriend. He's a musician on the road." She is between 6 and 8 months pregnant.
She doesn't know.
She doesn't know.
She's
and also,
never been to a doctor.
The movie's not sure either because she looks very pregnant.
Are you sick yet? Are you feeling sick in your stomach? Because that's how the movie makes you feel every second of the entire film.
So she's standing there, and he's painting her, and then she walks around to see. This is a guy. Let me reiterate. She has a boyfriend. He is her neighbor and has been her neighbor for quite some time. He's vaguely flirted with her. She has sort of vaguely flirted back. But there's been no sense of that what's about to happen is okay in any way, shape, or form. And so he's painting her. He steps over to get the baby robots to stop play fighting, and she she takes a sneak around look at what he's been painting. It is a fully done painting of her nude, a pregnant woman nude. Yeah. Her breasts are out, and she, rightfully so, for about a half second.
By the way, I know this is a small detail, and it barely matters. She's not just naked. She's wearing something she isn't wearing in life, which is a robe opened to expose her breasts and her stomach.
It is stunningly confusing and gross. And she says, hey.
Like, that's, what are you doing?
What are you doing? That's paint not some fair. Clothes on her. And he's like, oh, needle.
Well, he's
and
then, like, oh, I was just using my imagination and my x-ray specs. Like, ugh.
But it's played as a flirtation, as a seduction flirtation scene.
Totally.
That this artist would paint her naked. Okay, so that's one thing that happens. Another thing that happens in the film.
I mean, this despicable protagonist, I guess, is protagonist. I mean, I guess Hume Cronin.
I think Hume Cronin is the protagonist. But who knows?
But this guy who's supposed to be kind of, I guess, our audience point of view, because he's a regular white Joe, her boyfriend, her boyfriend shows up. Yeah. And she's very excited. She's like, hooray, Hector, my boyfriend. And she runs out to go meet him. And this guy gets so instantly depressed that he chugs a fucking
half bottle of whiskey,
yeah. And then starts throwing shit and like getting mad at everybody. And I'm like, every sign in this movie is, well, this deeply unstable piece of shit.
No, he is someone to be feared. Like,
yeah, he's terrifying. Yeah. He barges into her apartment
and steals his paintings back.
Is the first thing he does, and is like screaming. Ugh. Yeah, but the movie doesn't know that this is disturbing. Yeah, it's not playing it like it's a good character trait.
No, it's playing it like he's really entranced by this woman, and clearly she has a bad boyfriend, and clearly he's a good boyfriend. Why can't she see that? That's the movie's perspective, which is a deeply troubling perspective.
It's also very weird that we're to understand that they're going to be a couple, and he never one time talks about the baby.
Mm-hmm.
Not one time. She never has the baby in this movie, by the way. She's pregnant as a sign of distress and need.
Yes.
That's it. Period.
Yes. And also so she relates to the creatures in some demonstrable way. It helps to anthropomorphize them because she can relate to what they're going through. Here's another thing that happens in the film. Our dumb boxer guy, he obviously has saved this little baby's life, so he starts to train it with a dog whistle, because that's what you do. Trains it to fly into his pocket and mm-hmm. things. And then at some point, for unspecific reasons, here's the one scene I remember in the film, and this will lead to the dog whistle bit. This guy, Carlos, who Jessica Tandy is convinced that it's her son plot reasons, for deeply gross plot reasons.
You call them plot reasons?
Yeah. I mean, in that it helps get to the idea that she's missing her son and her son is in fact dead, and that's the vehicle through which they do that. So I would say it is a plot sort of device they use.
Wait a minute. I have a question for you, and yeah. I'm sorry to jump ahead because people aren't going to know what I'm talking about, but I'll forget. Is the last time we see Carlos when he dumps the flowers in the trash and walks away?
Yeah, that's it.
That's it?
Yeah, that's how
That's the end?
Yeah, yeah.
Fuck, man.
Yeah, it's dark.
All right, continue. We're going to tell the story of Carlos.
Sure. So, sorry. Oh, yeah. So Carlos. Carlos is hired by the developer to get the old people and the tenants out of the building. So he's constantly like bashing up their apartment and their buildings and like putting holes in their walls with his baseball bat. And his job
tears apart their restaurant, which is why the little robots need to come in and fix it.
He's like the ostensible protagonist who has a change of heart. Antagonist who has a change of heart. And so he bashes up a bunch of their pipes and a bunch of their electrical boxes. So they come down to see what's going on. The saucers come down. Carlos has an axe at this point, and then axes one of the flying robot saucers and kills it, basically. And this is the scene I remember as a child. Uh-huh. I remember this being really deeply disturbing to me, that there was an axe blade through this thing we've been told is real, basically. And it dies, and then, of course, they fix it and comes back to life. But while this is all happening, they run away after dumb boxer guy has trained this thing with a dog whistle. They recuperate, they fix each other, and then all five of these creatures now fly away. And then there's this nice New York scene where they have to go out and find the creatures. And dumb boxer guy, so fun. You really widened the scope of the film.
Oh, this was the only other thing I liked in the entire movie.
Which part?
Was that in the... Well, there's... Oh, no, there's two other things I liked in the movie. One of them is that during this walking around New York looking for the robot scene, you see a marquee for the Criterion in New York City, and it is screening both at the same time, Manhunter and The Fly.
Seems so
How
great.
How fucking awesome is that?
We were really excited to have been watching those films instead.
It was just a relief to think about how there are good movies in the world and that there's two of them right there. And wouldn't
Together.
You like to just walk out of here and go see those movies?
Yeah. Also, apropos of nothing, Jessica Tandy's character makes candy omelets at some point, just so you guys know.
I mean, this is the...
Okay, wait, so this dumb boxer guy grabs a megaphone and then runs to the top of the building with his dog whistle and peppers New York with amplified dog whistles, and then the creatures come back. That's another thing that happens.
Stupid.
There's like four or five other sequences like this that
Stupid.
Don't add up to anything.
Nothing. The movie is utterly plotless. I mean, it's not, because the plot is some developer is tearing up the building, but that takes up 7% of the film, like this incredibly small amount, and nothing else that happens contributes to that at all.
Can I tell you my theory?
Yeah.
Here's my theory about how this movie happened. Steven Spielberg, wait, before
I actually know the answer to how this movie happened.
Oh, okay, well, okay, listen, here's my theory. Steven Spielberg is involved in some capacity in this Twilight Zone film. He does a short film in it called Kick the Can, which we've talked about on this podcast, which I remember very well. It's about old people. My theory is that he was looking at ideas for this type of thing, a 30 to 45 minute piece, and he was looking at old people. And he comes up with this idea, or stumbles across this, thinks it's good enough to expand, and then instead does Kick the Can for Twilight Zone, or some version of this, and then says, can someone add an hour and a half to this idea? And they said, no, but we can just expand what's already there. And then they just ended up developing this into a feature. This is my theory of how this happened.
You haven't looked this up at all? No. You are stunningly close
is that
to reality.
True? Really?
You are stunningly close to what
is it Twilight Zone based?
No. Oh. But he had this show called Amazing Stories,
oh, sure,
which is an anthology series. And this was an idea developed for Amazing Stories.
Stop it.
That he's like, that should be a film.
Stop it.
Literally. So
oh
that's
my God,
exactly
I feel
so what
good
happened.
About myself
that's
right
exactly
now.
What happened.
Really? But they didn't think to develop it into an actual feature.
No. They didn't add anything of substance. They just added bits and bullshit like the entire time. And I will say this about the movie. Let's speak about Steven Spielberg for a minute. He didn't make this film, but his name is on it, and it was his
And they're
genesis.
Trying to do Steven Spielberg.
Big time. Yeah. And he obviously has a very bizarre and sickening soft spot for cute old people, which, you know,
is weird.
We can even extend into fucking Private Ryan and, like, other movies where he features weird, like, terrible old people.
Yeah.
He's this is a horrible weakness of his.
It's true.
And it is most exemplified by Kick the Can, but here it's the exact same problem. It's just Jessica Tandy has, again, I know I'm like overusing this word, but it's a sickening depiction of dementia.
It's gross.
And it's that dementia is delightful and charming.
It's
and
so fun.
And everything she does, and poor Jessica Tandy having to do all this shit. Yeah, make candy omelets and throwing little bowls around. And, of course, being the one who first discovers the robots and is like, they're flying little guys. And they're like, you're crazy, lady. And then there are fucking flying little guys. Everything is stupid and disgusting about it. She's dancing in the background, singing little songs.
Yeah, she's like, so delightful.
And it could not bear any less resemblance to reality. I just hate it. So anyway, but the reason I even talk about what I want to say about Steven Spielberg in a sort of positive way and this Frank Marshall, Kathleen Kennedy
trio
in this era is this movie looks beautiful and fantastic. It is extraordinarily well produced.
You said ILM did the special effects?
Oh, yeah.
They're great.
ILM did the special effects.
They're really good.
Joe Johnston, who, you know, would go on to direct, you know, Tremors and Jurassic Park 3 and all this other shit for Spielberg into Captain America. He did the second unit, so he was obviously he was creating his career, and his work is excellent. And the production, what's weird about this is 87, and it looks like, I only use this as a reference point because it's something I'm so intimately familiar with. The buildings and the lighting and the shots and stuff, it looks exactly like Roger Rabbit.
Yeah.
It has this really high quality kind of grime, which is, I don't know how else to explain it, except it's so unique to these movies. It's like Zemeckis does it. It looks like Back to the Future 2, for instance. Like, it has this really, really high quality production value, which is the hallmark, I suppose, of Frank Marshall and Kathleen Kennedy. Like, they are just really good at
it
building
looks great.
Movies.
And here's the thing that kind of clued me in, is that it's a great looking film with about 25 minutes of story in it.
Right.
And the movie is an hour and 45 minutes long.
Right.
And that's a really confusing thing to watch. And that's what makes me think that it's supposed to be more of a kid's thing. It's bits and sequences that are not especially interesting or funny, that have no tonal consistency, that have no morals to them when it comes down to it. But that's what the movie consists of. The movie doesn't consist of an A to B. And in that way, it is very similar to Short Circuit, which is a series of 10-minute sequences.
Right.
With no overarching connectivity.
Yeah. And
also kind of gross.
And I can I mean, I remember feeling this way about Short Circuit, although in a different way. And Short Circuit...
This is worse than Short Circuit, I would argue.
Are you just saying that because it's been
so long? Because I just watched it?
Yeah.
Yes, I am. I am.
Yeah.
That's why I'm saying it.
I mean, I was... wondering the same thing, like which one is worse.
I'm kind of amped up and annoyed right now by the film.
This movie,
so
you
think
know,
that
I
may be part of it.
Here's the thing: Short Circuit has a B movie trash quality that this doesn't. This part of what I was sort of getting at is that this polish makes me hate the movie more because it is high caliber filth.
Here's what makes me hate it more.
Moral
well,
filth.
Here's what makes me hate it more is that Short Circuit asks us to identify with Ali Sheedy, asks us to identify with the robot, and asks us to identify with Steve Guttenberg, and to a lesser extent, / not at all, Fisher Stevens. This movie is, music cue-wise, is really asking us to feel for these caricature people.
Right.
And asking us to have emotions for these insane beats. And that feels so aggressively gross to me and disgusting.
Yeah.
That makes me hate it.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, I agree completely.
Also, I've never been so bored in a movie.
I know. It's agonizing.
Can I tell you what I almost asked us to do? I almost, and I just was like, almost, I didn't care enough to do it. At about 30 minutes in, when I was just, basically the opening, which should have been the opening 5 minutes of what would have been a TV show, takes 30 minutes.
Yeah.
It's, oh, these old people are losing their building. Oh, here come the robots.
Oh, it's scene after scene of repetitive scenes.
So it's, like, it's the inciting incident should be the robots coming. It's the first act break, basically.
Which is also, you pointed this out and I noted it too. Why is that so poorly handled, the robot arrival? It, like, for a movie that it has such high polish.
Yeah. The way they introduce the robots,
it's like
which you've been
waiting
for. They
get lulled into their own boredom and then they forgot that the robots have to make a cool entrance.
They don't. Yeah, the robots do not make a cool entrance. You just sort of pan over from Jessica Tandy sleeping to see a robot outside the window flying.
Which is the
Are
video
they aliens
box.
Or robots? Aliens.
They're alien robots. They really. I mean, they, right. I'm not saying that to be funny. Like, that's what they are. They come. They clearly come from space.
But the movie never tells you that.
No.
You just assume.
No, and the movie is so, again, the movie is so lazy and sloppy and sick with how it handles this stuff. Like, Hume Cronin, when Marc Maron is asking him, like, how did these, like, what are they? Like, what are these things? Like, we have to call the army. We have to call the whoever, you know, government in order to find out how these things exist and whose experiment they are. And Hume Cronin is like, the worst thing you can do with a miracle is try to ask why it's here.
Yeah.
Like, that's his thing. And so then you're great. The end. Yeah. Like, no need to even bother with a story or reality, you know. Oh, that's another good line in the movie is, this is the 80s. Nobody cares about reality anymore, or nobody wants reality anymore. Or something
yeah,
like that.
That's said by the girlfriend of Marc Maron.
I hated the 80s-ness of this. Anyway, one thing that you said earlier that I wanted to touch upon is the cliché-ness of the characters.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of 80s movies that do this, and in many ways I'm jealous of the 80s as a writer, as a storyteller, because this sort of reliance on cliché just gets you further faster.
Yep.
And often it's kind of at the expense of any depth or interest, but it's an easy way to tell stories and an easy way to build characters. I was amazed at how this movie assembled this set of clichés and failed completely to even get me on board with the cliché. Like, it was so shitty and so bland and confused. Like, the collection of cliches don't work. Like let's take the brain-damaged boxer guy.
Yep.
So we understand that he's an ex-boxer. He's childlike and stupid. They imply he has sort of violent outbursts. He's working on tiles. He keeps trying to put together tiles in the movie, and he speaks in advertising slogans.
So the movie title,
they can't even keep consistent.
No, the movie title "Batteries Not Included" comes from him.
So the first line, he hasn't said a word. He's a mute, as far as we can tell, in this movie until he sees one of the robots with the other five people, and he goes, "Batteries not included." That's it. And then later,
deeply upsetting.
Later, he says,
"We bring good things to life," because he saves the.
Yeah, and then later he says, "Don't leave home without it."
And then at one point he goes, "I'll have what's behind door number one."
I'll take door number one, which is not an advertising slogan. That's just some TV bullshit. So
also, batteries not included. Not an advertising slogan, to be fair.
Well, it's in a commercial. I guess it's the idea that he watches TV because they don't establish that.
I think it's TV. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Oh, and at one, I wonder if that was cut, because at one point he takes apart his television to save the baby flying saucer. So I wonder if that was just cut out of the film, that he actually dismantles the thing he cares most about.
Yeah, so the one thing that they want to be his defining cliche characteristic, they cut. So you just have to kind of, in your imagination, be, I guess, this is what's going on.
Yeah, and I guess the idea of being a tortured artist is a trope that they sort of wanted to lean on, but they made him into a psychopath, so that's cool.
And they also, everything they do is wrong. They don't introduce him as a tortured artist. Mm-hmm. They introduce him as a guy who's trying to do building preservation because he lives in this dilapidated building, which is the last in this area of demolition. Mm-hmm. So this building is the last one to tear down because it's the last one with people in it. And so he shows up with a person from the city saying, this should be a historical landmark.
Don't touch it.
And she's
I wasn't sure if that was even the thing. I thought that was just a ploy he was doing to get the building saved. But also, it's almost too clever for him, and it's also not...
Exactly. And why does this guy care so fucking much? Like, if he's just a broke artist...
Here's a real question, though. Is it... What would the writers say here? What would Brad Bird say to this? By the way, Brad Bird wrote this, guys. What is the reason why Mason stays in that building? What would the writer argue?
I don't know that it's Brad Bird's creation in this case, but I guess the answer is, I mean, he defines it as this is reality. And so they think that he's trying to save something. I honestly don't know. I mean, I think that it does. If he were just broke, I would understand.
The answer is he has to be there for the movie to work, so they don't deal with it.
Also doesn't. They just wanted to put a 30-something white guy in the movie.
Oh, none of them have to be there for the movie to work. Let me be clear. But like in terms of the movie they want to do, he doesn't.
But your point is salient because he doesn't express a point of view. Yeah. He has no reason.
Yeah.
He has no reason to be there or want to save it. None. He doesn't care. He doesn't even know these people. He doesn't know anybody he lives with. He's like, you're my neighbor.
He just met these people. Elizabeth Peña is a soon-to-be single mother waiting for this guy who's never coming, basically, to come take her out of poverty and take her on the road. She rejects Hector, her boyfriend, in favor of this artist, which is confusing. But you at least understand she's down on her luck. She's in a situation where she can't afford to move. The old folks...
How she hasn't been evicted before now, I have no idea.
Very confusing. They also have no money and are looking on the verge of retirement into an old folks home. And then the dumb boxer guy is obviously can't hold down a job, so he's in around the building. But the
so
artist
all
guy...
all these people are just completely broke.
I think
so
it's just
on
they're
On some
poor.
Level, is this movie an argument for kind of... the generosity of welfare or something? I mean, I'm not trying to be funny, but like the movie's point is they should be left alone. Right? That's the thesis that it seems to be expressing.
I guarantee you
alone.
No one had that conversation. It's what is a device through which magical flying saucers who can fix things can fix someone's problem.
So this is people who cannot help themselves
being helped by
prey to the abstract, well, and then the robots show up.
Because
it's a thing in the movie.
That prayer thing is ridiculous.
Yeah. Tell them
I don't even want to deal with it.
Tell
man.
Them about it. You like this movie. Tell them about it.
This is my favorite movie we've done on the podcast. At one point, there's this extraordinarily long sequence. Hume Cronin is looking at his bills and looking at the coming destruction of his building, and he's by himself.
His wife is a baddie old broad.
Yeah, who is delightful and titillating. But
he's the only one who doesn't like her.
Yeah, basically. And he's also a terrible father who abused his child, from what we can tell from the film.
Not only that, he also has not been taking care of her all this
Someone else has been taking...
And
he doesn't know when she's supposed to take her medicine.
The movie doesn't investigate any of this. God. You just kind of have to draw these conclusions.
I forgot about that part. Yeah, he doesn't even know when her medicine...
The other old people that we mentioned, we said there's five characters and there's this other seven, this six and seven, this couple, this old couple who are their friends, I guess, are there, and they're the ones taking care of his wife. So he has not had a hand in her medication. He doesn't know how she's supposed to survive. Like, he doesn't know how to, like, when to feed her. Like, he's just, like, just been this piece of shit husband living there.
And her mental trauma, from what we can tell, stems from the fact that he and their son, Bobby, had a schism because he was a terrible father. And she mentions this multiple times. You never liked Bobby. Bobby ran away because of you. Turns out Bobby was killed in a crash. But maybe, I guess the movie's telling us that in the course of fleeing from his father, maybe that led to his death in some way.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. There's all kinds of dark things about him being a really bad person.
Yeah.
Anyway, doesn't matter. He's at the kitchen table and he verbalizes. He says, "Oh, God, can someone send help? Can someone help us?"
He doesn't even say God. He says, like, anybody out there.
Yeah, can someone help us? And then when the creatures show up and they can fix things, they don't understand that this one will in any way help them at this point. But he does say, maybe they came for me. He thinks, okay, they answered my prayers. He verbalizes this to his friend. And then the movie takes about 7 minutes to go to each character and tell that character, hey, maybe they're here for you. Maybe they're here for you. Maybe they're here for you. But they haven't done anything. They're not like angels at this point who can serve a purpose. They're weird flying saucers who don't have demonstrable skills at this point. And they're acting as if their life is now saved. But in no way is that the case.
Nor do we, and again, the movie eliminates the question of why are they here by saying don't ask. Yeah. Like, they have no motivation for anything.
But the movie spends 7 minutes to say don't worry about it, which is really weird.
Well, on that level, yeah, but the movie doesn't, like, any question why are they here is at the core of any kind of Alien Contact movie some level.
Yeah.
And this movie says don't. That's not what this is about. This is about them being angels.
The movie also sacrifices its own internal logic for a gag, and I pointed this out. I know to not think about logic when it comes to late 80s films. I know that. I'm going to do it for a second, so just bear with me. I know it's a fucking dead end, but there's this gag where the flying saucers are helping out in the kitchen of Hugh Cronin and Jessica Tandy. Jessica Tandy, by the way, we're told can't remember anything. She cannot take care of herself. She cannot remember to take her medicine. But we see her walking through the crowd, rattling off fucking four orders
to Hugh Cronin in the kitchen. It's totally selective dementia in order to be cute in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she's like, you know, egg salad on rye and a hamburger with pickles and onions. So she's got the whole thing. She tells Hugh Cronin, and then she picks up a burger to deliver to a counter guest, and we see this. And
where
she
did they even get all this fucking food?
Like, don't worry about that, man. Let me worry about this logic point I'm talking
about.
I
just want to say, after the robots put the restaurant together and they decide to go open up for business again, there's a shot of the hot dog machine turning on for the first time. Yeah. Hot dogs are in there. How old do you suppose those hot dogs are?
I mean, at least 20 days. Maybe more.
Longer than that. They're a year old.
But no, because they've been open. They were serving food at the top of the film.
Sort of
sporadically. People had stopped coming because it was in the middle of a construction zone. So the reason people start coming is confusing to me, except most of them are construction workers. Doesn't matter. Don't worry about that part. Worry about this dumb part. That there's this really stupid gag on the griddle where the flying saucer's flipping over the burgers, whatever. And then it sends out a burger with the bun together and the meat on top. And then it goes out, and Jessica Tandy's like, oh, this burger's not right. Remake it. And then Hume Cronin goes back to the flying saucer, goes, oh, look, let me show you a picture of a hamburger. The meat goes in the middle of the bread. And you go, okay, cool. I get that they need to be specifically told what to do, even though for sure that wasn't the first hamburger they'd made. Don't worry about it. At the end of the film, though, the whole movie adds up to this. The bad guys and Carlos burn the fucking building down. It burns down to the ground. It's a shell of itself. They're now going to demo the rest of the base of it and then put up this massive skyscraper, right? But overnight, the flying saucers come back and bring all of their flying saucer friends, and overnight they rebuild the building. And I said to Kaylin, We've been told they cannot assemble a three-part device, which is a hamburger, correctly, without being explicitly told. They have no blueprints of the building. They've built everything from scratch. And I said,
beautifully
restored. And I said, why? And, yeah, better than it was before. Yeah. So why would they sacrifice that ending for a hamburger gag that wasn't even funny? Why did Kaelin, why defend that choice?
Boy, they thought it was very funny.
Is that it?
You see it. You see two buns together and a burger on top. Look at it. Got you again.
Yeah, it's good. That's right. I hadn't thought about it. It's a pretty funny image.
Yeah. Can we deep dive on Carlos?
Yeah.
For a second?
Yeah, and then let's stop talking about this movie.
Yeah, this is the last topic I have to discuss. Okay, oh, good. Can I say the one other thing I liked?
Yeah.
I feel like we've paced these out very nicely. Mm. The other thing I liked in the movie is one of the final shots of the film, when they look at this restored building, you see a crowd of New Yorkers, and they're your average 80s crowd of New Yorkers. You got your punks, you got your
goths.
punks and goths.
They're side by side.
But they got mohawks, and then they're also like your average people and your workers. Whatever, your old people. And just a typical New York crowd. And among the crowd, Luis Guzman.
Just looking good, by the way.
In like one shot.
Looking great.
And I knew the second I saw him. I was like, that is Luis Guzman. Sure enough.
And it was Luis Guzman.
Not
and
credited.
He's doing that fake talking, the peas and carrots, peas and carrots, peas and carrots in the background. And it's great.
But I can see how somebody would see that guy and be like,
that guy's
pluck
good.
Him out.
Yeah.
He's great. So all right, Carlos. So the bad guy, the main antagonist of the film, I'm going to go ahead and say, is the most compelling performer and character, and not by design.
100%.
And he's a guy who is leading this gang of.
Would say Hume Cronin's a good actor in this film. Go on.
I didn't think so.
He has nothing to do, but I think I like.
I could be ageist.
This is the movie that made me like Hume Cronin. Go on.
Ugh.
Yep.
Did you like him in Cocoon?
Didn't like anybody in Cocoon.
Well, I didn't like anybody in this, but except for Carlos. So this guy, he's leading this pack of punks.
Actually, think of Break Into Electric Boogaloo.
Well, think of the punks in Short Circuit 2 who want to kick your balls into outer space. That's essentially who this is. So this guy's
Los Locos.
Yeah, Los Locos. So he's tearing up the building and he's scaring people out, trying to get them to leave the building. That's his job. He's been hired by the real estate developer to get these people to leave so that they can knock the building down. But he is having a crisis because all he wants to do, he expresses, is get out of town. He's trying to make enough money to leave New York. And he's found this job and it means the world to him because it's his only mechanism to get out. So there are scenes designed to elicit a great deal of empathy for him, actually, after he's been introduced as the bad guy.
Yeah.
Added to that, Jessica Tandy keeps mistaking him for her dead son.
Mm-hmm.
And so she keeps calling him Bobby. He's this Latino guy, Carlos, with a ponytail, and she's sure it's her son. And so over and over again, she's like, Bobby, come here. Come over for ham. Like, we're making dinner, Bobby. And everyone's like, it's not Bobby. Stop calling him Bobby. It's
By the
not
way,
your son.
I just have to add that normally I don't think Caleb's impressions are spot on. This was spot on. Like, Jessica Tandy is doing that voice the entire film. She's in a British stage drama. She's like in a British pantomime play. And everyone else is like in a sort of vaguely naturalistic New York world. Go on.
And so
Bobby.
So she won't stop calling this guy Bobby. And it, as with everything in this movie, it goes that you see 55 scenes of this until finally he sort of softens and is like, wow, you know, you think I'm your kid. And this actually kind of in a funny way touches him. And he's sort of surprised that this woman is opening her heart to him, even though she's confused. And he obviously wants that on some level.
Yeah, he never had a father.
And he talks about, you know, how his relationship with his father wasn't good or whatever, like vaguely, like just thrown out there.
Yeah.
So then the movie goes through. So then that's interrupted because he sees another robot and he's like, who cares? So in the end of the movie, Jessica Tandy is trapped in the building when he sets it on fire. He and another guy set it on fire. I know what you want to talk about.
No, I do so badly.
Oh, no.
It's my favorite part of the film.
You want to take a moment to talk
about
that?
Yeah, I do, because here's... So here's what happens, you guys. This guy...
I can't believe we almost forgot to
talk this
about
is the best part of the film. Okay, you guys. Okay, so here's the strategy. So Carlos fails, and he goes back to the big skyscraper, big boss guy, who's like, Carlos, you're out of here. I'm bringing in your boss to do it. Your boss is going to burn the building down since you weren't able to get these people out of the building. So this guy in basically a suit goes into the building. And I'm excited. You'll remember, Kaylin, I voiced my excitement because he's not just setting like newspaper on fire and throwing it in the basement. He has this whole thing where he has poured some salt on the it's whatever explosive salt.
Amazingly elaborate system of destruction.
Yeah, but the movie, again, like most things, takes about 3 minutes to do this. We see him setting up this device to blow the building up. It's a milk carton filled with like some sort of nitroglycerin, and it's positioned appropriately, and it's got a time delay on it, and he knows how long these chemicals take to interact, and he's like got it all timed out. And I'm thinking, this is great. This guy really...
This is going to turn into something pretty spectacular. Yeah, the movie doesn't want you to understand how it works, but you're like, whoa, boy.
This is good. They brought in efficient. The chemist. They brought in the chemist.
Yeah.
So the movie cuts away for another 20 minutes or whatever. When it cuts back to this guy, he's got a staple gun in one hand, and he's staple gunning balloons to the ceiling.
Colorful balloons.
Filled with some unidentified liquid. Like, these are liquid-filled balloons he's staple gunning to the ceiling, and there's like 30 of them.
Can I also say, not to interrogate the logic of all this, and I know that we want to get back to these colorful balloons.
This is my favorite part of the film.
But when Carlos goes and says, I'll get these people out of here, and the boss guy is like, you've had your chance, you're fired, I'm getting someone else to do it. That guy's whole plan is blow up the building. It has nothing to do with getting the people out of there.
No, and Carlos could have blown up the building.
Easily.
They didn't give
Carlos
him a chance.
Says that. He's like, I could burn this place down.
Yeah, you didn't give me a chance.
If that's all you want.
I didn't know that's where we were at. You just didn't give me the right information. I thought we were in a different phase of the routine. You didn't tell me. So you're feeling bad for Carlos. He didn't know that's where we're at here. But then when he realizes that's where they're at,
Travis
he starts trying to.
So Travis is – here's the experience. Travis is watching this, and I'm looking over at him, and he's really frowning at the screen. Like, what is going on with these balloons? Like, I can tell that this is where his head is at. It's like, what are these balloons and why? And he's like – and so he's like venturing forward. Like he's like, maybe he thinks I know or something. But he's like, well, so what – why or is he doing this with the balloons? And I was like, don't worry, dude. This is really going to pay off.
Yes.
I was sure, like, the movie can't be so sloppy as to take all this time to staple colorful balloons to the ceiling
of
the basement.
A liquid they haven't told you. I am assuming maybe gasoline, but then why do you staple gun gasoline to the ceiling?
And it's like, this is going to be good. Someone had a pretty fucking awesome idea for how to destroy a building.
Kaylin looks at me and goes, because Kaylin, for some reason, based on our experience up to this point, has developed trust in the film out of nowhere for
reason. You weren't like, oh, this is bullshit. We were both trying to figure this out.
What's
like,
going
this
on?
Has to be a thing.
I mean, guys, 30 balloons. And then, whatever, it doesn't matter. Some shit happens that doesn't matter. And then the nitroglycerin mixture blows up. And you're like, oh, this is, here we go. And then the movie cuts to the basement full of staple gun balloons on the ceiling. That blows up.
Well, they just fall down.
They serve no purpose, though, is my point. The room catches on fire.
Also, Carlos, by this time, has kicked open gas lines, so the room is full of gas, which is what causes the explosion. So this guy, and the guy's all like, we have to do this in this very precise way, Carlos, because this is the only way they won't know that we burned down the building.
I mean, you're extrapolating. He doesn't say that.
No.
You're attributing motive. Is that what it has to be talking about? Because who knows? Because who knows, Kaylin?
But why is this plan B? Plan balloon. That's what it is.
I don't know. All right, anyway, go on. I just
have
to talk about
the balloons. All of this shit is going on, and these two guys, Carlos and this other guy, are arguing about how to destroy the building, one with balloons and the other by kicking open gas lines. And they have
Carlos, a lot more competent, ironically, at phase B.
Truly.
But wasn't given the chance to do it.
They have both failed to realize that Jessica Tandy is still in the building. Now, the only reason anybody's not in this building is because they're out looking for the baby robots. And so Jessica Tandy, they just left behind because that's what you do with an old lady with dementia.
To be fair, she's not helpful in that. You don't want to bring her out into the city. She's not helpful.
She wouldn't be helpful, but she's there alone. Mm-hmm. But it's a good thing she's just cute and doesn't have a real problem. So she's in her window, And she's going like, oh, Bobby, it's me, your mother. And Carlos is like, oh, no, nice old confused lady who thinks I'm her son is alone in the building. Someone's got to go in there and rescue her. So Carlos, God bless him, takes it upon himself to go try to get her out. And he goes in the building and he gets into her room and she's in her apartment. He kicks into her apartment and she's like, you're not like, what are you doing here? Like, get out of my house. And he's like, it's me. It's Bobby. It's your son, Bobby. This is his mechanism to get her out of the house.
Fine.
Very sweet.
Fine.
He's like, you know, I'm your son, and we got to go downstairs because Dad's down there. So come with me, Mom. And this is this is emotional for him because he has a rough relationship with his parents. So then he says something like, Dad's a great guy, and he's waiting. And she goes, you're not Bobby, because he likes his father.
Think about how dark that is. What breaks her out of her movie-long dementia about her son is the idea that her son could like her husband. And that is so jarring to her that it cures her dementia. Like, that is such a crazy idea for a family film. Oh, so, you like your father? You're not my son. Get the fuck out of here.
So then
ludicrous.
It's insane. So she runs away and locks herself in a different room. Then I can't even remember what happens. But Carlos still gets her out. He still manages to drag her out of this building to save her life. So then all this other bullshit happens. The robots put the fucking building back together. Who cares? But the next time we see Hume Cronin and Jessica Tandy is at the hospital where they're all recovering from having been near a fire, I guess. And here comes
the grossest moment of the film.
Well, yeah. And so Hume Cronin's like, you know what? We lost. The building burned down. He doesn't know the robots have put it back together yet. We are moving to an old folks' home where we should have been all along.
For sure.
It's going to be great. They can take care of you and us.
Also, he didn't do that before for reasons that are unknown.
Inexplicable, in fact. And so she's like, I want to go home. And she's all upset. And so then guess what happens? Here comes Carlos.
Fucking Carlos.
And he's
with flowers.
He's got his hands have been burned, so he has bandages on his hands. He's wearing for him nice clothes, and he's got flowers. No, but really, like that's what it's supposed to be. He's supposed to be all cleaned up. He comes and he says, you know, I brought these for your wife. Like, I want to see her and I want to make sure she's okay. This obviously means a lot. And Hume Cronin lights up and he's like,
so
fuck.
Gross.
This is so fucking weird and sick and horrible. He goes, oh my God, honey, look, it's Bobby. Bobby is here with flowers. So Carlos has now become Bobby. He's allowed himself to simply become her son. And she starts crying. Carlos turns away, throws the flowers in the trash can. That's it for Carlos.
Roll credits.
It's so fucking crazy.
I don't get it, man.
That's the whole arc of Carlos.
But here's the thing. Having been through this conversation, we started by saying it's supposed to be a family movie. And in the late 80s, were people that different than they are now? Like, have people become different as humans? Like, that doesn't work for any generation, I would argue, for a family-friendly film. I get what you're saying, but what I hear by family friendly is not that it attacks four quadrants. It's that it attacks zero quadrants, and you don't know where else to put it.
I guess. I don't know. I think this is trying to be four quadrant.
That is so. But why take the chance of deep emotional scenes
they
or
stillbirth? They didn't mean to get to any of this. They didn't mean to get there. They didn't mean to do anything. The movie is doing things that they are out of control of. Like, that's the answer. They don't know what they're doing. How they shot that shot of Carlos throwing flowers in a trash can and walking away, and we're like, good. They sort of slapped their hands together, and they're like, that takes care of that.
Wrapped it up.
Like, I have no idea. I have no idea. I honestly have no idea. And then the movie ends with this equally depressing and bizarre shot, which is that they move back into their house, and the building developer people have built a fucking superstructure all around them, and now this house is like the house and up, you know, which is just sitting there in the middle of a giant thing. And that's the shot. So there's no shot of the characters. This is just, well, they stayed there, like, for no purpose.
And Kaelin,
they're probably
dead. As Kaelin correctly pointed out, that by the time those buildings got built, those people are dead. So we're looking at a shot of an exterior of a building full of people
knew. These down on their luck, poverty-stricken, hopeless people have managed to create a historically preserved building, and that's the triumph of the film.
For someone else. It's really about the building. The building is the protagonist.
It is. It's a story of how this building survived.
Yeah. And I guess Mason is now the father of Elizabeth Peña's daughter?
Definitely not.
Yeah, he went back
to his old girlfriend, Elizabeth Peña.
she moved to Chicago
into an abusive relationship with her actual boyfriend. Hector. Like, it's a nightmare.
All right, anyway.
An urban nightmare.
Let's draw a movie for next week because I think Batteries Not Included. I will say I'm happy that my curiosity is sort of assuaged here because I now know what happened with this movie. I also, by the way, before you draw that.
No, you're drawing it.
Okay. I will say I understand why I did not remember this movie. Because
sure.
I did see this. There's shots of this I remember. I remember the axe blade in the flying saucer very clearly because that was disturbing to me as a child. But there's nothing for a kid to hang on to in this movie. You cannot hold on to a plot. You cannot hold on to relationships.
No.
None of it makes sense to a kid. And so,
it is amazingly similar. It's not nearly as entertaining or insane as Cocoon. But it is more vile, but it's obvious why a kid would mistake
it. But of course, if you're listening to this movie and you don't remember, when we started the episode, if you didn't remember Batteries Not Included, but you were sure you saw it, that is why. There's nothing for a child to hang his hat on or her hat on. There's nothing there for
the
you.
The image of robots, which is basically the VHS cover, which is what I think of when I think of this movie.
I'm going to draw a film now.
Can you do something to save this show?
Yeah. I'm going to pull a good movie.
The podcast is actually on the line right now.
Okay.
So you've got to pick something.
I'm
going to
pull a great one. I'm going to pull one, not two, out of it. I got the one I want.
Mean, this might be a time to do like a freezer. Oh, man.
Well, I mean, look.
I mean, I've done this before. I may fucking nix this. What is it?
Wait, here's the thing. I want to say it is one that is good for the podcast. It may be. I'll say this. It's maybe good for the podcast. It's definitely good for the podcast. It's better than the film we just watched and worth talking about.
You know it well?
We both know it well.
What is it?
Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Oh. You know what's so funny? I just watched it like a day or two ago with Dallas.
Oh.
So I could do it right now, baby.
I want to talk about Rick Moranis, and it's obviously a good sweet spot for the podcast.
You know what?
That's
Joe Johnston.
Oh, is it?
Isn't that funny?
Is it good?
This is interesting. This is the first time this has ever happened. I just watched it. It'd be a really boring show.
If you just watched, let's pull a different one. Let's take turns pulling.
Yes!
Let's take turns pulling. Here.
This is fucking awesome. I just watched it. It's fine. The effects are cool. That's it.
Great. The end. Is Rick Moranis fun?
Not really.
Great. Next week.
Oh, we already watched this one.
Okay, I'm pulling again.
This is Evil Dead. How come this is still in?
We did Evil Dead 2. We didn't do Evil Dead 1, did we? Oh, we did Evil Dead 1.
We did Evil Dead 1. So this is that's a bust.
Okay,
all right,
here we go. Oh, we are going to watch this one.
It's not
the one I wanted from them, but it's one I like. Next week on Does Your Favorite Movie Suck, we're going to watch Monty Python's The Meaning of Life.
Oh,
That'll be fun.
That's very funny. Yep.
All right. Join us next week. Bye.